From KPFK Pacifica Radio, this is Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. You can watch this program on Free Speech TV and listen to it on Pacifica radio stations and affiliates nationwide. On the same day that Americans went to the polls to vote in the November 3rd election, on the other side of the planet, Afghans were reeling with the aftermath of yet another brutal and violent attack, this time aimed at Kabul University. Armed men carried out an hours-long attack, killing 22 people and injuring nearly two dozen more. Dozens of students scaled the walls of the university to escape. The attack was initially claimed by the Islamic State, but now there are reports that the Haqqani Network, an offshoot of the Taliban, may have been responsible. Here in the United States, the military is expecting to receive orders from outgoing President Donald Trump to withdraw forces from Afghanistan shortly. The war in Afghanistan is the longest that the U.S. has ever officially waged in any nation. And although there was a peace agreement signed with the Taliban, violence continues to plague the nation. My guest is Dr. Hakeem Naeem. He is a lecturer in the Department of History at UC Berkeley. He grew up in Afghanistan and lived in multiple countries as a refugee and immigrant before moving to the U.S. Welcome to the program.
Thank you very much. Thank you for having me.
So first, tell me about the attack on Kabul University. There was so much news here in the United States that attack and the news of it really didn't get much attention here in the U.S. at all. But for Afghans, it was shocking.
Yes, unfortunately, as you mentioned, there was a so-called peace deal with the Taliban, with the U.S. and the Taliban in February this year. The Trump administration had finalized the deal with the Taliban. But however, that so-called peace deal was actually a moment of escalation of violence for Afghans. After the peace deal, we see the violence increase in Afghanistan more than 38%, according to some statistics. And a direct targeting of the civilians also increased. And this time we see an attack on students and educational institutes. On October, we have an attack on a very important educational course in a Hazara neighborhood of Afghanistan, Kausar of Danish, that killed many students, young students. And then in November 2nd, we see an attack, and we had a very brutal, bloody, terrible attack on university at Kabul University and killed more than 50 students, most of them young students, part of the School of the Law. The attack centered on the School of the Law, which was a terrible attack. This is really unfortunate that when we talk about the peace in Afghanistan on one hand, and on the other hand, we see an increase in violence from both sides. It was not just Taliban that increased the violence. After the peace deal by the U.S. and the Taliban, we see an increase on the bombing by the U.S. and coalition forces as well. The 10 to 15% there was an increase of bombing the villages as well. So on the both sides, we see an increase of the violence, but who pays? The Afghan civilians. And unfortunately, the killing of Afghans was very much normalized, that even it doesn't get any news coverage or any attention from the outside of world. So what we did as a group of international scholars with a very much permanent anti-war activists, such as Noam Chomsky, we issued a statement of solidarity by all scholars from all around the world. We have scholars from Pakistan, from Iran, from Turkey, from Afghanistan, from US, from all around the Europe, to condemn violence by all actors, also demand protections of Afghans, civilians, especially students and educational universities. Also, we want to demand that these attacks should be investigated and all actors who are involved in this war should be responsible. We want to say that it is enough. The Afghan killing should stop immediately. The civilians have been paying the war, the burden of this war more than 40 years, and after the Soviet invasion, I mean the US invasion in 2001, more than 20 years. So this was the first time that we are a group of Afghan scholars took an initiative to have a statement of solidarity and condemnation of this attack. And we want to all people that who think about justice, who think about peace, should support this initiative, because as I say, the Afghan killing and the dehumanization of the Afghans is easily normalized the killing of Afghans and Afghan civilians, unfortunately.
So this statement of solidarity seems to suggest that there is a particular targeting of educational institutions in Afghanistan. So there have been sort of two back-to-back attacks on educational institutions a few weeks apart, but in different parts of the country. Is this, do you think, a pattern?
Well, yes, the pattern actually began earlier. So we had like last year two attacks on educational institutes, mainly again in Hazara neighborhood, which was the university entrance exam preparation education institute. And 20 or 25 people were killed, most of them students and teachers. So the patterns exist, right? But after the so-called peace agreement with the US, we see an increase by deliberately targeting the institutional education. So to some degree, it has a history. Yes, the pattern has a history, and it is a pattern. But the increase of it is unacceptable, and it is very sad to see the students are paying the burden of the all invasion and war.
So what has the aftermath been in Kabul? Kabul is the capital in this latest attack that took place November 2nd. You mentioned at least 35 people were killed, 50 or so injured. How are people recovering from this? And how is the government responding? Because the Afghan government, which has been backed by the U.S., has played an interesting role, because although they enjoy the backing of the U.S., they were left out of the negotiations with the Taliban.
Exactly. The government of Afghanistan, which is supported and which to some degree instilled by the U.S., it's literally kind of constructed and put in power by the U.S., in the last 19 years, if I say. But the government has very limited role in a bigger security measures. So now after the peace deal with the Taliban, there's more a blaming game, who did it? So the government says the Taliban did it, or a group of the Taliban did it, the outside international community trying to say that, well, that was the Daesh or another groups.
But Daesh is another name for the Islamic State.
For the Islamic State, yes. That's also as part of like the attack, more than being looking for the civilians and their as a victims. It becomes like a blaming game between different actors in Afghanistan. Yes, government is very much losing to some degree power. Now these the major highways, freeways are controlled by the Taliban, and or groups that affiliated with Taliban or called different names. This is also the sad part, that we actually don't know who is the enemy, who is friend in Afghanistan after all these 20 years of the war. So the government was responsible to protect the civilians, but I don't want to say the Afghan government is a functioning government. No, they cannot function. Outside of Kabul, they have very limited power. So the government failed to protect even civilians inside Kabul, which is the capital and should be protected. But here also the international forces, international actors who are very important part of this process are responsible, and they need to protect.
So let's talk about that. The Trump administration has had well, let's just say an incoherent policy in Afghanistan. It has talked about wanting to withdraw troops, but it's escalated the bombing. It has worked on a peace deal with the Taliban and then briefly withdrawn from that peace deal, gone back into the peace deal, signed it. Now attacks escalated against it. You mentioned on villages, attacks have increased. Now we're hearing reports that the Trump administration wants to withdraw forces from Afghanistan before Trump leaves office as sort of maybe one of his last acts. It's not clear if he'll actually do it or if he'll even manage to do it if he wants to do it. But can you make sense of the Trump policy in Afghanistan?
Well, I think we should look at a little bit in a broader sense. What to some degree Trump administration tried to do it in a very impulsive way, in a very kind of sensationalist way, in a campaign kind of oriented way, is a continuation of that, the war on terror that began in 2001. We see similar kind of path or pattern with Obama administration as well. If we remember that in 2011, there was a surge escalating the war, which very much escalated and spread the war all over Afghanistan, north and south. And then we see in the 2014 that withdraw troops under the Obama administration. To some degree, yes, the Trump's kind of methods might look incoherent, but in terms of a broader sense of a pattern of the US policy in Afghanistan, it continued the policies of war on terror that Bush Jr. started and Obama continued and to some degree Trump continued. Yes, Trump is unpredictable. Trump is a very impulsive, is very sensationalist. He left to turn every single, even human suffering, war into a campaign kind of oriented way. But I think there is a continuity in terms of what Trump did in Afghanistan.
How much of a role is the U.S. directly playing in Afghanistan right now? I mean, there are not that many troops left. It's about 4,500 U.S. troops. The Pentagon, according to CNN, has issued a notice to commanders known as a warning order to begin planning a drawdown of troops to 2,500 by January 15th. This is not a very large number of troops. I imagine that they're sort of concentrated in certain parts of the country. Are they playing directly a big role? We know the indirect role, of course, is much bigger.
Yes, the indirect role is bigger. Directly also in terms of air power, U.S. is the very main power in Afghanistan.
Still, I see.
They have extensive drone power in Afghanistan. Nowadays, they are even working with Taliban, supporting drone power with the Taliban. And they say that while the Taliban is fighting with Daesh or ISIS, they should be supported by air. So that's a very important power in Afghanistan.
Are you saying that the U.S. is now directly supporting the Taliban with air power against the Islamic State?
Yes, there was a recent article on Washington Post in that regard as well, that how the U.S. Supported during when there was a war between the Taliban and the Islamic State forces in Afghanistan, the U.S. supported the Taliban side by attacking the ISIS with drone planes and drone bombardment. So yes, there is. And now we have reports that the Taliban are using drones as well. So that adds more complexity to the war in Afghanistan. But when it comes going back to your questions, yes, they have direct power, direct role in the war, despite the fact that they have less troops. I mean, the U.S. has less troops in Afghanistan, but they have a very important power. Also, they have an enormous leverage over the Afghan state. So the Afghan state is a client state, literally kind of goes by what the U.S. says. We see the releasing of the more than 5,000 Taliban soldiers. Some of them were not part of the Taliban. Some of them were very much extreme criminals that were released as a part of this peace deal with the U.S. So U.S. plays an enormous role in terms of influencing Afghan government or Afghan state, and also having a strong air power controlling Afghanistan.
So the Los Angeles Times on Monday published an article entitled "Born into Occupation, Young Afghans Fear the Taliban Will Crush Their Freedoms When U.S. Troops Exit." And this has been the long conundrum of the U.S. war in Afghanistan, that when the U.S. removed the Taliban from power in 2001, 2002, and the years after, propped up a puppet government, they created a situation where essentially U.S. troops were also the same ones bombing people from above, were ostensibly there as a bulwark against Taliban fundamentalist extremism. And then we were told the U.S. couldn't withdraw troops because what will happen to Afghan women, or what will happen to young people, because the Taliban has shown itself to be a backward regime. So here we have, you know, more than 19 years into this war, and the LA Times is still saying that young Afghans fear the Taliban will crush their freedoms when U.S. troops exit. What do you make of this framing of this story?
So one thing is that the Afghan people now, the majority, if you do a very important kind of research or poll, they don't want a U.S. troops in Afghanistan. At the same time, Afghans don't want the Taliban to be back as well. So there is a fear of the Taliban coming, not just by among the young Afghans, of course, young Afghans have a lot of concerns, but among all Afghan people, my family live there, I'm constantly in contact with them. Everybody fears that the Taliban can come back. At the same time, the Afghans, to some degree, believe that the U.S. presence also leads, or to some degree enables, the continuation of this war that strengthens the Taliban or the Taliban-like groups. So if we think about the Afghan people, young or old, they were, to some degree, kind of stuck between two rocks. And this is the unfortunately the calamity.
And I was just going to say that the United States, of course, did very little to help strengthen civil society and other democratic institutions, non-governmental democratic institutions, to help, you know, protect the country from the influence of the Taliban in these nearly two decades of occupation. Let's look ahead to what you think you might expect, or what you expect will happen under the incoming Biden administration in Afghanistan. So what you expect and what you would hope that Joe Biden could do. If you were to give the Biden-Harris administration advice as an Afghan, as someone who's been studying the situation, what would you like them to do in Afghanistan?
Okay, before I answer your question, the point that you made was very important, mm-hmm. about that how U.S. to some degree weakened the institutional of Afghanistan that historically was placed. I'm a historian, so I study Afghan history. But by not creating strong civil society, but at the same time by creating a culture of NGOism that actually paralleled to the state institutions, that to some degree prevented state building. Despite the fact that we call that, oh, we are not there to nation build, or we did a lot of nation building, that's to some degree has to be rethink and rediscussed. No. The U.S. tried to bring a culture of NGOism, that is, by creating parallel institutes to the state institutes, that to some degree prevented nation building and state building in Afghanistan. I just want to make that clear. Coming back to your questions, I want to be hopeful. Yeah, that's very important. We should be hopeful. But I see, as I say, that the U.S. foreign policy is bipartisan to some degree. There are important kind of set building blocks that whoever is the president to some degree carries the same policies. So we know Biden was the vice president during the Obama administration. He had a very important, to some degree, very concerning ideas about Afghanistan. He was arguing for dismantling Afghanistan into 3-4 different regions, right? Or just having a small counter terrorist forces in Afghanistan and leave it to Pakistan or to the regional forces. That's to some is very important to think that it can be destructive, because instead one Afghanistan, if you're dismantling it into three or four, into smaller, small little blocks, you created more than one Afghanistan. Yes, I hope Biden administration rethink this this policy of peace with Taliban. The Afghans want peace. Peace is a very important part. We should genuinely work for peace. But we have to think about that, who the Talibans are, who are the other groups, how
right, because in signing a peace agreement with the Taliban, doesn't the U.S. leave stronger the same group, the same institution that it started this war against? You know, so it started out with in this war fighting the Taliban, and in signing this peace deal, it leaves the country, leaving this institution strong once more. I mean, it's legitimizing and validating the group, right?
Exactly. Legitimizing, validating, and making it stronger, given the fact that Afghan state is very weak and it's not supported in terms of, like, in a broader sense, just supported in terms of what the U.S. wanted the Afghan states to do, right, in that sense, as a client state. Yes, Taliban should not be legitimized, should not be become an important force. The force that, as you mentioned rightly, that we fought and we tried to, the war began, remember, by going against the Taliban extremists. I wanted Biden administration to rethink its regional policy. Its regional policy about in Pakistan, in India, in Iran, in Russia, because Afghanistan problem is not just limited or restricted to Afghanistan itself as a geography, but it has a important regional consequences, regional implications. So Pakistan should be pressured. Now Pakistan is our very important ally, and Trump, when the Taliban deal, was very much important part of the Pakistan. So the Pakistan should be pressured and should, the deal should be rethought, that what is the species and who is the Taliban. And I wanted Biden administration to support the Afghan people, Afghan initiatives. We should get rid of this NGOs culture of NGOism, kind of creating
NGOism, meaning non-governmental organizations, right? That have sucked up so much money and not done very much and been
exactly,
quite corrupt.
Exactly. Yeah. Of course, there are very important NGOs that work side by side with Afghan people, and that's. But there are bigger culture created that just creates parallel institutes to the Afghan state. We should strengthen Afghan state. Very important.
And then very quickly, what about
directly for us?
What about NATO in Afghanistan? Because this is an international, you know, European slash together with the U.S. institution that saw Afghanistan as a reason to continue existing in the post-Soviet world. And of course, the U.S.'s relationship with Europe frayed in the last 4 years under Trump. Do you have any sense of what NATO's goal is in Afghanistan currently and in the European nations in general?
Well, NATO until now followed to some degree exactly, if I can say the word, the U.S. policies when it comes to Afghanistan. So the U.S. was the greater kind of force within NATO, controlling it, funding it, and setting the policies, and then NATO followed it. During the deal, this was the question with the Taliban deal as well, the so-called peace deal, that what's going to happen to the NATO forces. But the U.S. agreed that the NATO would kind of withdraw with the U.S. forces, according to one of the provision of the deal between the U.S. and the Taliban. So despite the fact that European countries say that they are going to continue supporting Afghan people, I think that the U.S. is the bigger player here. And if the U.S. decides what the U.S. decides, NATO would follow it.
I see.
I
want to thank you so much for joining us today, and we'll certainly follow the story and see what Trump and Biden do in the coming months on Afghanistan. Thank you so much, Dr. Hakim Naim.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
My guest has been Dr. Hakeem Naim, a lecturer in the Department of History at UC Berkeley. He grew up in Afghanistan and lived in multiple countries as a refugee and immigrant before moving to the United States. We've been discussing the ongoing war there in the wake of the brutal November 2nd attack on Kabul University. I'm Sonali Kolhatkar. We're online at risingupwithsonali.com, where you can sign up for our daily newsletter, find our audio podcast on iTunes and Spotify.